The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Larry Wilson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Retirement Guide, Centennial Money Magazine, and Kiplinger Magazine. The pros and cons of downsizing. Moving to a smaller house can save money. This article appearing in The Retirement Guide. You may love the home where you've spent your adult life and raised your kids, but for many, the potential benefits of downsizing are enough to consider a move to somewhere more modest. A smaller house can mean lower utility bills, fewer maintenance costs, and more money to put towards making retirement affordable. But moving can also be costly, and downsizing could mean moving away from your support system of family, friends, or neighbors. When deciding whether downsizing is right for you, it's critical to consider the advantages and disadvantages. What are the advantages of downsizing? Well, you'll have more money and time. Not only does moving to a smaller place mean you'll have less house to maintain, but it can also mean paying less in housing costs and utility bills. If you're worried you may not have sufficient savings for the lifestyle you want in retirement, downsizing is one way to reduce your living cost and property tax burden. It can give you more time to devote to hobbies and more money for travel or savings. Better accessibility as you age. Downsizing also gives you the chance to look for a home that's better suited to an aging body. If your current home has stairs and you're worried about your mobility, look for a single-level home. You may even look for homes built with seated showers or wider doorways for wheelchair accessibility. These types of updates and renovations can be expensive to add to an existing home, but if you are already planning to move, you can choose from homes that meet your accessibility criteria. Choice of location. If you live far from family, downsizing provides the opportunity to move closer to loved ones. If you want to lower your cost of living and save money, you could look into moving to a state or city that is more affordable than where you currently live. Be sure to take into account state and local taxes when considering a move. And remember that downsizing can make living in a state with property tax a more feasible option. What are the disadvantages of downsizing? Moving cost. While relocating to a smaller house can potentially save you money in the long run, keep in mind that moving itself is expensive. This is especially true if you plan to hire professional help. The average cost of a local move is about $1,500, and the average cost of a long-distance move is about $4,000. You may also face miscellaneous expenses like utility company fees to close or open new accounts, storage unit fees, and the cost of packing supplies. Leaving your community. Opting for a smaller house might require you to move away from well-established community bonds, neighbors, and family. If you've lived in your current house for most of your life, adjusting to a new neighborhood can be a challenge. This is an important factor to consider for your mental health. Less space and privacy. A smaller home means less space for your stuff, and you'll likely need to sell or donate a lot of your belongings to fit into a pared-down space. If you're planning to transition to an apartment or retirement community, you'll be in much closer quarters with others than if you were in a single-family home. This can be an advantage for those looking for more social connections, but getting used to sharing a wall with your neighbors and more noise can be an adjustment. Downsizing can be an opportunity to move somewhere that better suits your lifestyle, while trimming expenses and reducing your cost of living. On the other hand, moving can be stressful and costly, and you may underestimate the emotional ties you have to your current home and community. When deciding if downsizing is the right option, do your research first to give yourself the best chance of finding the right place to live out your golden years. Our next article, appearing in Kiplinger Magazine, by Emma Patch. What to do with your former employer's 401k? American workers voluntarily left their jobs, setting the record for the most departures in a single month. Since then, the so-called Great Resignation has yet to show signs of slowing. Another 4.5 million people quit their jobs in March, and another 4.4 million quit in April, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And some believe the Great Resignation isn't a temporary phenomenon, but a permanent change. Job turnover is 20% higher in the remote and hybrid working world, and is likely to stay that way, according to Gartner, a technology research firm. If you recently left or are planning to leave a job with a company that provided a 401k plan, you have several options. You can leave it behind. Most of the time, it's okay to leave a 401k plan with your former employer while you're transitioning to a new job, says Andrew Rosen, a certified financial planner and president of Diversified LLC in Wilmington, Delaware. However, don't leave the money behind if you have less than $5,000 in your account, which could happen if you didn't work for your former employer for a very long time. When the balance is less than $5,000, the company is permitted to cash out your plan. If that happens, you'll be required to pay federal and possibly state income taxes on the balance, as well as a 10% penalty if you are younger than 59 and a half. You can roll it into your new employer's plan. If your new employer allows you to roll your money into its 401k, that may be a good option, particularly if it offers a portfolio of solid, low-cost investments. Large 401k plans often offer institutional-class funds that have lower fees than funds you can buy on your own. That may also be the case with a former employer's plan. Plus, you can borrow from your current employer's plan, which isn't an option if you leave the money behind, or roll it into an IRA. If you choose to roll the money into your new employer's plan, make sure you don't exceed the maximum contribution you can make in a year. Company 401k providers are unlikely to communicate with each other and will often let account holders contribute the maximum, even if they've rolled over contributions from another employer's plan. For example, suppose you're younger than 50 and roll over a plan in which you've already contributed $10,000 this year. The maximum you can contribute to your new employer's plan for the rest of the year is $10,500. If you exceed that amount, you could be subject to a penalty of up to 6% of the excess contribution. Roll it into an IRA. If your new employer doesn't permit rollovers, or you're not impressed with its investment options, you can roll your 401k into an IRA with any financial services firm. Rolling over your 401k into an IRA could also allow you to build an investment strategy that's more customized than you would get in a 401k plan. Unlike 401k plans, which typically offer a limited number of funds, IRAs offer a broad menu of investment options. If you go that route, make sure you take advantage of resources provided to you by the financial services firm, such as information about the funds, historical fund performance, and manager information, to determine the best lineup for you, says Caitlin Neat, a CFP for Bartlett Wealth Management in Cincinnati. As you approach retirement, you'll probably want to shift to a more conservative asset allocation, and an IRA may offer more fixed income options than you'll find in a 401k plan. And if you've worked for several different employers, rolling the money from each 401k plan into an IRA will allow you to consolidate your savings into one place. From Kiplinger Magazine, an article written by Janet Bodnar, A Good Time to Teach Kids About Money. My column on motivating kids to save from the Money Smart Women article dated February continues to generate advice from readers. Here's a sampling. For our kids, we devised an income savings program that we called 40, 30, 20, 10, write Craig and Lisa Olson. Each week, when they got their allowance, they put 40% of it into their hands for spending, 30% into an envelope for short-term savings, 20% into an envelope for long-term savings, and 10% into an envelope for church. The kids didn't like the program too much at the time, but now they both tell us that it was good training for budgeting as adults. Lee Hobbs Stege writes that she and her husband didn't like our sons watching a lot of television, so we gave them the option to earn $200 a month if they watched only 2 hours of TV a week. They used the money to buy stock, she says. As someone who has written extensively about kids and money, I'm always encouraged by success stories like these from parents who have given their children a head start on managing money. Without guidance, it's too easy for kids to go astray. For example, in a survey by LendingTree, nearly half of parents with minor children said their child had used a parent's credit or debit card without permission at least once and racked up an average of $500 in spending, most commonly with in-app or in-game purchases, ordering food delivery, as well as buying things through voice-activated speakers. In the annual Parents, Kids, and Money survey from T. Rowe Price, 40% of kids agreed with the statement, cryptocurrency is the future of investing. And a study from family finance company Greenlight spotted a financial confidence gender gap among teens as young as 13. Some 33% of boys, and they are confident, said that they are confident in their personal financial knowledge, compared to about 21% of girls. Money stressors. On the plus side, the Greenlight study also showed that money was the second most talked about topic among parents and kids behind the pandemic. And both parents and teens agree that gas prices and inflation are the biggest financial stressors right now. So it's a perfect time for a financial intervention with your kids or grandkids. And there's empirical evidence that financial education works. A major research paper analyzing 76 randomized financial literacy experiments involving more than 160,000 individuals found, quote, strong evidence that financial education improves both financial knowledge and behaviors, especially when it comes to budgeting, saving, and credit. The effects of financial education are 3 to 5 times greater than reported in previous research, and there's an effect across all age groups, says Anna Maria Lusardi, university professor at George Washington University and one of the study authors. The pandemic crisis spurred interest in financial literacy, and inflation may also give it a big boost, says Lusardi. There's been an exponential growth in the amount of research, and we have gotten better at doing financial education, she says. Overall, about 24 states require some form of financial education, and more are considering it. But it all begins at home. I've interviewed many people in the finance industry, and if you ask what inspired their interest in finance, they always say it goes back to their family, says Lusardi. An article from Centennial Money Magazine, Start Your Startup. These first steps will help you turn your brilliant business idea into a reality. The prospect of launching your own company is endlessly appealing. There's the inherent passion working on projects you created. There's the flexible schedule that stems from being your own boss. And of course, there's the possibility of getting rich. After all, few people have become truly wealthy by working for someone else. But taking your business idea and getting it off the ground can be a daunting prospect. It can feel a bit like skydiving without the safety of a parachute. With proper preparation and a calculated approach, however, you'll be setting yourself up to succeed. To create a solution, there's a reason that thousands of infomercials over the years have launched into their pitch with a single reoccurring phrase, there has to be a better way. Customers are looking for solutions to their problems, and as a business person, your job is to offer a good or service that solves at least one of those problems. Some of the startups that succeed most quickly are born out of solutions to problems that the founders experience themselves, whether it be food offerings to fit certain dietary restrictions or clothes to fit an expanded range of body types. Your product doesn't necessarily need to be personal to you, but it needs to be personal to someone. Study the competition. If your idea is good enough, in other words, if it solves a problem large enough that you have thousands of potential customers, you're probably not the first to think of it. And you're probably not the first to try and execute it either. While many would-be founders throw up their hands upon Googling their product and finding that it already exists, that's a major mistake. Think about it. You've never heard of any of those companies, right? That in and of itself means there's opportunity. Study up on your future competitors until you can describe how your startup will execute on your vision better than they do. Ignore the doubters. If you think you'll receive much positive feedback when asking whether you should take a leap and launch your startup, well, you may want to think again. Those who don't particularly want to see you succeed will attempt to sow seeds of doubt, hoping they can convince you to back down from your dreams. Even those who do have your best interest at heart may not be overly supportive. After all, would you enthusiastically advise a loved one to leave the security of a full-time job? At the end of the day, starting your own business is about betting on yourself. And that's exactly what you need to do. Everyone else can get on board later. Get everyone on the same page. Some of history's most successful businesses were founded by partners. Think Bill Gates and Paul Allen at Microsoft. Collaboration is a formula that can produce incredible results. Then again, think of Mark Zuckerberg versus Eduardo Saverin and the Winklevoss twins at Facebook. When co-founders aren't on the same page, disastrous results, including plenty of lawsuits, can ensue. To make sure no wires get crossed between you and your co-founders, have explicit conversations about how much time everyone will be committing, who will be fulfilling what roles and responsibilities, and how much equity everyone will receive. Critically, document all of these agreed-upon decisions in writing. Involving a lawyer never hurts. Perfect the art of the pitch. In the early stages of your entrepreneurship, you'll find yourself engaging in different versions of salesmanship. To prospective employees, you'll have to describe why your new company is worth them joining you. To prospective manufacturers, programmers, or other product-making partners, you'll need to articulate exactly how your product should look and feel. To potential investors, you'll need a rock-solid grasp on the market opportunity for your product. And most importantly, you need to be able to pitch future customers on how it's going to make their lives easier. Learn from your users. As your business scales in size, it's important to stay true to your vision. No one knows your product better than you, and you should hold firm on its most important aspects. That said, a flexible business person is often a successful one. Feedback is an opportunity to refine your concepts, and no one is going to provide more feedback than your customer base. You'll receive plenty by tracking customer behavior, but don't be afraid to reach out directly. If your product is good, users will likely be eager to tell you how it could be even better. From Centennial Money Magazine, an article entitled "The Art of Negotiation: Understanding Your Worth and Knowing How to Get Paid Accordingly Makes a World of Difference Over the Course of a Career." Congratulations, you got the job offer. But your work isn't quite done yet. It's time to negotiate your salary. Many people are hesitant to talk about money, and many are uncomfortable with negotiation. So it's no wonder that a lot of folks forego salary negotiation. However, no matter how uncomfortable it makes you, you owe it to yourself to ask for a higher salary. The stakes are too high not to. For example, assuming a 5% annual raise, a worker who enters the job market with a $55,000 salary will make $634,000 more by the end of a 40-year career than a worker who begins with a $50,000 salary. Yes, the stakes are high, but that doesn't mean you need to stress. With some thoughtful preparation, negotiating a higher salary is relatively simple. Know the market. While applying for jobs, part of your process should be identifying the typical salary ranges for the roles to which you're applying. There are a few different ways to get at this information, and you should utilize all of them. On websites like LinkedIn, Indeed, and Glassdoor, you can find salary estimates based on industry-wide data, or even better, reported salaries from actual employees of a given company. if you have close contacts who work in the type of roles that you're looking at, ask if they can provide a general range for the purpose of your search. While pay transparency is becoming increasingly popular, you shouldn't be so direct as to ask someone their exact pay. Lastly, it's more and more common for job postings to include a salary range. If a company is upfront with that information, chances are their numbers align with or exceed industry standards. Aim high and justify it. After receiving a salary offer from an employer, thank them and let them know how excited you are by the prospect of working there. Then ask them if they're open to negotiation. Some companies simply won't negotiate, which is fine, and you'll need to decide whether to accept the pay that they offered. But most companies do negotiate, and if given the opportunity, you should ask for more than you were offered, even if you like the initial offer. When making your case, point to accomplishments throughout your career that have added value to your company. More importantly, identify what you'll do to bring value to your new company in the future. Keep it positive. Even if you're not thrilled about how negotiations are going, or perhaps merely made anxious by negotiating at all, make sure to project nothing but a calm positivity in your correspondence. Reiterate that you want to work for the company to reassure them that your interest is genuine, not just a play for leverage elsewhere. Don't haggle over things as being stingy, and don't say over like a single vacation day, it's not worth appearing greedy or combative. Remember, the people you're corresponding with are hopefully your future coworkers, and this is your first impression. Lastly, don't put out ultimatums, which are unproductive more often than not. Also consider the whole package. Remember, the single number that constitutes your base salary is not the end-all be-all when deciding when to accept a job. When comparing offers, you need to add in bonuses, profit sharing, 401k matching, insurance premiums, and anything else that contributes to your personal bottom line. Well, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Larry Wilson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.